Hello and welcome to Novara FM, brought to you by Novara Media and broadcast live on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's most singular and most exciting of radio stations. I am James Butler. Very often on this show, we're drawn into questions of politics which focus on Westminster. I hope, differently from elsewhere, it's not our exclusive focus. And when we started doing this stuff a good few years ago now, we were convinced that the wake of the financial crisis meant politics was changing, and we were frustrated that very little seemed to be asking big questions about politics and about the fundamentals of politics, from street protests to attempts to capture the institutions. If that has changed since, it hasn't really changed enough. So I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by Jack Schenker, whose new book, Now We Have Your Attention, tackles just those questions. The book is a richly detailed and richly textured account of the new forms of politics which have arisen in Britain since the 2008 financial crisis, and really enriched by first-person reporting and countless conversations with people, ordinary people, who have been drawn into politics in its wake. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to talk about some of those stories and what those stories mean for politics over the course of the show today, but I sort of wanted to start by saying, this is really the first book I've read which is like a history of the present and a history I recognise. It's partly, I think, a matter of being involved in left politics, and especially a left politics mostly interested in politics done from the bottom up, for a good long time. That I recognise people in the book, and the stories resonate with stuff I've seen, stuff I've done. It's a great achievement, I think, perhaps especially in the sense that there's now something to point at and say, you know, this is what we've been talking about, and this is what has been going on. So thank you for that. And perhaps it shows that the apparent chaos of the last few years has been brewing in something deeper and something more interesting, and which has been going on, I think, for quite a bit longer than is sometimes recognised. So maybe we can just situate the book a bit first. And where did the impulse for it come from?
Well, that's a really kind introduction and a great way of conceptualising what the book is trying to do. The book is really rooted in my own frustrations, and you alluded to them there, and it sounds as if you shared many of them. Since 2008, for me, the landscape upon which our politics plays out has been completely rearranged. Institutions and norms and traditions and assumptions that we have built our kind of acts of political contestation around have crumbled around us, and a battle is on to build a new country, a new society from the rubble. And yet, certainly in those early years after the financial crisis, and in the initial period of the Conservative and Lib Dem coalition government, there was really no shift, as far as I could see, in the way in which the media conceptualised politics, the lens they used to report and evaluate it. At the time, I was living out in Egypt, in Cairo, reporting on the revolution and then the counter-revolution out there, and witnessing a country that was engulfed in turmoil. And I looked back at Britain, and I knew from my own experiences and from the experiences of friends and colleagues and comrades that life on the ground in the UK was being transformed as well. Obviously not in a revolutionary context, but nonetheless, the justification that an economic system that had dominated our lives for the best part in 40 years, you know, for you and I, that encompasses an entire lifetime, was falling apart. And people were trying to find new narratives, new stories, and new forms of political mobilization and organization to respond to that. And yet, I mean, I use the analogy in the book of baseball correspondents in the American South in the 1930s and 40s, many of whom were very diligent and very assiduous in their reporting, and they covered the results of the games and the transfers between the teams. And the one thing they never did was discuss the fact that baseball was segregated racially at the time, or that there was a nascent civil rights movement sweeping through the country that would go on to change its history. They operated entirely within the boundaries of the thing they were supposed to be reporting on, and never questioned its wider structures. And albeit in a different context, I think a similar category error was going on in Britain in relation to kind of politics after the financial crisis. So I really wanted to address that. And then once the 2017 general election came along, itself in the aftermath of the EU referendum, and these kind of earthquakes and volcanoes began erupting on the surface, that sort of redoubled my determination to try and tell a different story, and to go out there and look beyond the parlour games and the parties and the personalities of Westminster and really get at the root of why the tectonic plates below were shifting.
There's a striking phrase you use. You quote Aditya Chakraborty in The Guardian, where he talks about media as operating like a court, as in, you know, courtier rather than court of judgment. It just struck me because I'd seen, I saw the other day Chris Morris in an interview with Channel 4, the satirist Day to Day and Four Lions, also referred to this kind of court-like atmosphere. And there's something very striking just at the beginning of the book where it becomes very apparent that, certainly by your judgment, I think by mine as well, that it's not, it's not only that the press has failed to understand what's going on around them, it's a question of whether they even have the tools to do so, that the mode of thinking just isn't there. What are they missing?
Well, you mentioned Aditya Chakraborty, who's fantastic, and he has this great quote about it being as if the French Revolution of 1789 was being covered entirely from within Versailles. I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, there was, in those early years of post 2008, post the financial crisis, a lack of realization and awareness about the ways in which people's lives were concretely getting harder in a really tangible way. And I'm not just talking about austerity here. I'm talking about the consequences of the particular brand of late capitalism that we've lived with for several decades imploding, and the way in which the winners and losers from that process were being represented, the way that process was being justified and legitimated. So I think that was missed. But even more importantly, perhaps, and something the book really tries to hone in on, is the fact that the inadequacy of both the media's coverage and the formal political institutions we rely on to mediate power and privilege and resources in our lives were proving completely inadequate to the task, as, you know, everything around them was falling apart. I think William Gibson, the novelist, has this great quote, which I'll be bastardizing here, but it's something like, you know, if you want to understand something, study it when it's falling apart. And my word, the last decade has been a wonderful insight into how things work in that respect. And so in response to that, people have been forced to find new forms of mobilization and resistance. And that is, what the book concentrates on. We're often told this is an anti-politics moment. And I actually quote one of the characters in the book saying, anti-politics, this is the epitome of politics. People are inherently political at the moment. And so ranging from radical education courses run by young people in Manchester to new forms of labor movements, insurgent labor movements, represented by, you know, migrant workers, precarious workers, up to renters who are finding ways to come together and battle the power of landlords in the streets. These are the ways in which people are really looking around them and seeing that the future, there is no turning back to a kind of technocratic consensus, right? That, you know, that the circumstances under which third way Blairism have dissolved, and the battle now is on is over kind of what's going to be built from that. And these are people who are going out there and they are trying to build an alternative.
It's striking, actually, you quote Helen Thompson, Cambridge political economist, earlier in the book, to the effect that we're still living in 2008, right? So one of the things that has been very difficult, if you sort of write about and think about politics in this period, is, you know, why has it taken so long for this, you know, two things happen, right? You have this kind of conversion of crises. So there's the financial crisis, which determines a great deal. Things we have also, which also plays a role in the book, is the ecological crisis is sort of increasingly dawning and structuring the way in which people do politics. And then there are just this kind of long enduring political crisis, which has taken actually quite a long time to arrive. I think, I look back on when we started doing this show back in 2011, which is a very long time ago now. but we started doing this, and you know, one of the, you know, and actively involved in some of these movements, right? Mm. So actively involved in you know, student protest, actively involved in some of the stuff that was beginning to happen on the streets at the time. And there was just this extremely difficult problem, which is that, you know, all of this was starting on the streets, and it was, you know, there was this kind of incredible ferment, and formal politics and the institutions are just sort of bumbling along as if nothing had changed, and it was very hard to see how that stuff would begin to filter through. I think since then we've seen it start, but it does seem to me that we're still, you know, it still feels very much like we're in kind of an interregnum here. You know, obvious Gramscian allusion there, but you know, let's dive into some of this, because that feeling of being kind of in between, that feeling of being sort of somewhat almost lost, is sort of the emotional tone that begins the book, yeah. Right? And I thought it was interesting and in fact important that the book starts in Manchester rather than in London. Yeah. You know, it's one of the things that has become increasingly apparent to me, as a Londoner, you know, someone who's born and bred here, and really, you know, I don't get out to the rest of the country enough. You know, the more I have, the more I see the way in which London not only shapes but warps thinking about the way in which this politics works. So tell me a bit about these young people that you were talking to in Manchester and what they were encountering.
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, thank you for picking up on the fact that you know, the book does try and get out of London. I mean, I would say that it you know, there are a couple of chapters set within the capital, so it's not only geographic, this attempt to kind of find new stories. There is a chapter set actually in Westminster, but it tells a very different tale from the one you might expect, and maybe we'll get onto that later. But Manchester is absolutely fascinating. I mean, historically, it has always been a window onto both the kind of prevailing economic orthodoxy and also movements against it, right? I mean, you go to somewhere like Free Trade Hall, which was built to celebrate the repeal of the Corn Laws and, you know, fulfilling the logical destiny of competitive free markets. But that's also built on the site of the Peterloo Massacre. I write in the book about in Ancoats, which is the neighbourhood in Manchester where these kids are holding their radical education course, and it's the site of a lot of speculative property development, privatisation and so on. That was the hereditary baronetcy of Oswald Mosley. But also in Manchester, you had lots of people mobilising to support, you know, the Spanish Civil War, to fight Franco and fight fascism. So it's always been a window onto these moments of kind of flux and fever. The kids that dominate the first chapter, and a fantastic array of characters, all came together for a course called Demands of the Impossible, run by two former school teachers who became incredibly frustrated at the limits of particularly the economic syllabus, the GCSE and A-levels that they had to teach, and how limited the imaginations and ideological breadth of that course was. So they started putting on this course that has since gone all around the country. And what amazed me when I joined them in Manchester was that the kids coming along to this course came from very, very different backgrounds. There is a child called Kyle who comes from Oldham, now the most deprived urban area in England, who has suffered homelessness, and we can get more into his story because it's a fascinating one. There is a woman called Layla whose family arrived from the Congo when she was very young, who has worked incredibly hard, and her family have worked very hard to give her what they thought of as the expectations of a typical middle class graduate, that she would go on to get a good degree, buy a home, have a secure job, start her own family, the sort of social contract that you know, would have been familiar for many people over the past few decades, but who in reality has seen that kind of path blur and warp. And then finally, a young woman called Hannah, also a fantastic character, who actually comes from a very rich background. She's descended from a former viceroy of India. She's very, very aware of her own privilege. And yet, even with all of the material benefits that she gets from having a trust fund and occasionally hanging out with Jacob Rees-Mogg, she can see that the status quo is completely unsustainable. And these three kids, through their different stories, I think the thread that unites them is that they are struggling against the cancellation of their their future. David Graeber, the anthropologist, describes despair fatigue, and these guys are utterly done with despair. The politics that they are pursuing is radical because they have no other choice. They are so disinvested from the existing system. And so the book follows them as they come together, plan, and then carry out their, what for all of them is their first protest about youth homelessness in the centre of Manchester's Piccadilly Station, which then gets swooped upon by the cops. And I try through their stories to really give a picture of what is happening to young people right across the UK at the moment and the ways in which they're coming together to change that.
I mean, there's something striking just at the end of the chapter, which is, you know, which sums up some of this problem in some ways, is one of the protesters holding a big, you know, sitting in a corner with a big kind of cardboard placard saying, "Can you see me?"
Yeah.
Right, and there is this question, I think, that runs actually throughout many of the chapters is, you know, the ways in which, or the ways in which people don't count, and whether figures in authority or figures who are involved in politics can see this stuff around them. It was in Brighton, you know, a couple of weeks ago, as I know you were as well, for the Labour Party conference and this fringe event, World Transformed, which we will come on to talk about because I think it's, you know, quite a crucial part of this story. But one of the things that was just so appalling was the level of street homelessness in Brighton, and the kind of just the way in which you would watch people just sort of ignore or like move away from, or simply their eyes would slide over, you know, this phenomenon around them, even I assume, you know, relatively progressively minded people. Just tell us a little bit about Kyle's story, because I think it's really, you know, really epitomizes some of this stuff.
Well, Kyle's story actually tells the story of property-led so-called regeneration in our major cities and financialization, and also the austerity that has followed the collapse of some elements of that economic system. As I say, he's born in Oldham, comes from a very deprived background. His mother, unfortunately, had mental health difficulties. He was often left in sole charge of his younger sister when he was growing up, and sadly was subject to kind of family abuse. Now, at the age of 15, he ended up running away from home. And if you zoom out, you can directly map the various stages of his life story to what has happened to certain parts of Britain over the past 10 years. So Oldham is one of the top 10 worst hit local authority areas under the austerity programme in the entire country, right? It's had to cut hundreds of millions from its budget over the past 10 years. And in the year that he was forced to leave home because of his mother's behaviour, Mind, who implemented mental health services in Oldham on behalf of the council, had their funding cut by 80% there. The following year, when he was already living on the streets, an initiative which was designed to mediate between runaway teenagers and their families was shut down completely by the council. Almost £1 million of children's care spending, adult social services spending, and youth spending was cut by each of those from Oldham's budget in the time that he was moving between hostels and places on the street and friends' couches and so on. And he often ended up sleeping for the night up against the billboards of new build luxury apartment blocks that have been blanketed over central Manchester. In the mid-90s, Manchester came under the control of a Labour council run by Richard Leese and Howard Bernstein, who unapologetically pursued this very property-led regeneration policy that has seen towers soaring into the sky. In fact, there are so many housing units now at the very highest echelons of the market, the Financial Times has warned of oversupply. And yet, at the same time, you have kids in that area sleeping on the street right up against them. And so through Kyle, you can see these kind of twin impulses developing within the city, these incredibly expensive housing units, largely unoccupied, bought by global speculators as kind of bank accounts in the sky, largely owned by tax havens out in Jersey, out in Delaware, often by sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf, built not to respond to the supply and demand of the local market, but to meet the needs of global capital. Whilst meanwhile, at that time, you know, Manchester's homelessness level rose 13-fold in the past 9 years. And Kyle was the victim of that. But he's also, you know, it's really important for me in the book not to present people as passive, as merely individuals to whom things happen. They are active agents. And Kyle found out about this Demand the Impossible course, joined up to it, and actually ended up leading one of the protests. And for me, that's one of the most kind of exciting and insurgent and dynamic stories in the book.
It is remarkable, actually, that throughout the book there is this sort of, you know, astonishing question, really, and it makes sense when you're reading it, but then when you step back and think, okay, you know, not just these kids in Manchester, but some of the people whose lives you narrate in Tilbury, people who are victims of the kind of Windrush border regime scandals. You know, these are people who have had terrible things happen to them and, you know, plausibly are living with all sorts of trauma and stress and the consequences of this, you know, even physically in their bodies, right? And yet, at the same time, they take action. And there's something quite remarkable about taking action in that situation. And you know, it's a long story on the left in some ways, right? That people take action even in situations of hopelessness and in situations of extreme stress. And sometimes, you know, people find themselves in that moment. And yet, there does seem something particularly unusual about it happening in the wake of Thatcherism, yeah. Right? So one of the things that you talk about is this sort of Polanyian line about the way in which the market has escaped its kind of confines and now structures the entirety of society. So that's something like remarkably different to the conditions in which people have struggled before. Do you have any sense of how people in these situations find that kind of hope and the ability to act?
Yes, it's a really, really good question, because as you say, I mean, that's a thread that runs through the entire book. And it's so important for me to portray through its pages the fact that, I mean, if there's one message I want people to take away, it's that we are political actors. You know, we are not merely economic consumers. We do not have to stand by and watch these dynamics play out passively. You know, the book ends with a real plea for collective action, especially in relation to climate change, which you alluded to earlier. And the point that it's up to us the way the future plays out. It's up to our, you know, the way in which we gather together, the way in which we build political movements together to shape what kind of future is going to arise from this. I think for many of the characters in the book, you know, the initial impetus just comes from the lived experience of their lives. They're not moving necessarily in radical left circles, in academic circles. They're not versed in the theoretical histories of resistance and kind of abstract debates around how we build parties and movements and so on. But they have experienced, you know, very, very viscerally, as you say, often on their own bodies, the ways in which the existing system exploits and devastates and immiserates. You mentioned, for example, the hostile environment scheme. You know, one of the most powerful characters in the book for me, or pair of characters, is a guy called Theo in Glasgow, who was caught up in the Windrush scandal, and who went from being a carer for a local charitable institution on night shifts, where he's lived in Britain almost his entire life, came from Kenya in 1968, but his entire experience has been within this country, suddenly finding the hostile environment spinning borders around him, and he was eventually told to leave the country, and it traces kind of what happened to him there. But also, just as importantly, a woman called Yusra, who is of Sudanese origin but actually grew up in Qatar, and who came here and claimed asylum after Qatari security agents kidnapped her father and arrested her mother for their political activities, and whose asylum case was, as so often happens under our current Home Office, rejected. She was sent to Yarl's Wood. She had an absolutely horrific journey through the violence of Britain's immigration detention system, and yet who, also ending up in Glasgow, joins an organisation called the Unity Collective, who are incredibly finding ways to resist the logic of the hostile environment. It's migrants-led. This is not about white middle-class people coming in and saying, "Look, we've learnt the theory. Let us teach you how to you know the praxis." It's completely the other way around, and that's something that runs through the whole book. Not just the Unity Collective, but organisations like United Voices of the World, the migrants-led trade union, organisations like London Renters Union, led by private tenants themselves who are on the wrong side of the housing crisis. So it's all about building from that lived experience.
Let's talk a bit about collective action then. Because the chapter, as you've just alluded to, the chapter on UVW, the sort of new unionism, new trade unionism, it traces the story of a woman called Fatima, whose story is just extraordinary, and actually really very moving. I'm a soft touch for stories of collective action anyway, but like I think even if you're not, that it's quite amazing. But it begins, and you quote this sort of rather dreadful independent political correspondent Sean O'Grady, saying the strike is dead. This form of collective action is something from another time. It no longer works. It's no longer wanted or needed. The trade unions, really, they're dead. They're kind of basically guilds. And in one sense, right, that's not completely wrong. Leftists will always sort of reach for those wonderful graphs that show the decline in strike days and the rise in sick days, right? As this kind of telling you something about this incredibly privatized sense of your relation to work. And here, I think more than anywhere, or in discussions of this stuff more than anywhere, there does seem to be this kind of instinct that the only two options are what we're living through at the moment, or an attempt to kind of crunch into reverse gear and try and get back to a period in which trade union density and trade union work was much more powerful, much stronger in the workplace. Do you think there's a kind of danger of that stuff, and is it a correct reading of the situation?
Well, I think when it comes to labour movements, what's really interesting is that the Sean O'Grady line about kind of labour militancy kind of withering on the vine only makes sense if you have a very, very fixed conception of what trade unions are and what labour movements are. Certainly, if your idea of a strike, of a struggle within a workplace, consists of your kind of old school beer and sandwiches, trade union bosses from the 70s sitting across the table from a sort of soot smudged kind of, factory worker or miner, then absolutely, strike days have fallen. Trade union membership, especially among the young and especially in the private sector, which obviously the growing areas of the economy, has been going down year on year. And yet if you shift your gaze slightly, and this is very much, what the book is about, you see a completely different picture, because actually in every facet of the economy, every cultural institution that you might have engaged with, from the Royal Opera House to your local cinema, every food you might have eaten, from McDonald's to the fanciest option on Deliveroo, the people who deliver blood for hospitals, the people who clean and guard our biggest office buildings, the cities and towns around us, everybody who is involved in maintaining those networks and those systems, has right at the heart of all of them, there are examples of labour militancy and strike action. They're just often happening below the surface, and they're playing out not usually through the traditional trade unions, although some of the trade unions, and the bakers union is a fine example of this, are kind of at the forefront of new forms of organising. But largely, either they're happening spontaneously and organically in a very networked and non-hierarchical way. I talk in the book about Deliveroo and Uber Eats drivers, and this is based on the research of other fantastic people like Callum Cant and Jamie Woodcock, who I'm sure people will be familiar with. There's a great scene of Uber Eats drivers having this wildcat strike and sort of logging off, and they realise that they can create new accounts and get a £5 credit, and they're also able to order food for less than £5. So they all just log off from their kind of rider mode and start ordering food as customers, which first of all means that Uber's shelling out all this money for food. Secondly, it means new riders keep on turning up, and they're met by the sea of Uber Eats guys and Deliveroo guys chanting, "Log out, log out." So there's that. But then in the middle, you've got this new generation of trade unions, and listeners might be aware of IWGB, the Independent Workers of Great Britain. United Voices of the World is the one I concentrate on in the book, who are trade unions, not affiliated to the TUC by and large, largely migrant-led, who are winning victory after victory through a very different conceptualization of union politics than those bigger predecessors. You know, I quote Petros, one of the organizers at UVW, talking about this is a movement. We're not just trying to empower workers within the workplace. We're not trying to provide a kind of doctor-patient relationship or a service union where you come to us and say, I'm having this issue at work. How are you going to solve it for me? We are trying to empower our members as workers, but also as citizens, you know, as residents in a city. You know, we see these things as interconnected. And these guys are winning victories time and time again. They are militant. They are confident. They are willing to hold wildcat strikes. Mm. They are willing to occupy. And I follow them as they occupy very dramatically everywhere from the Ministry of Justice to Kensington and Chelsea Town Hall. And that is where Labour activism is at the moment. And Sean O'Grady can't see it, but it's there.
I mean, Francis O'Grady can't see it.
No,
but I mean, there is something here, and there is often, I think, a caution among certain parts of the left to say, okay, these small trade unions are doing kind of amazing stuff, but there's a reason the big unions exist, and yes, they have absolutely their problems, and it, you know, it's great that the small unions actually also have the latitude to act, you know, whereas the larger unions are kind of confined by anti-trade union legislation, which has never been repealed in this country. It wasn't repealed under the last Labour government, should have been. And so I wonder, you know, there is often, I think, a fear about this stuff, which is that it's eye-catching and it's, you know, incredibly inspiring and it's doing some really impressive stuff. The question, and again, it's a question that comes up, I think, towards the sort of middle to the end of the book, is that question of the relationship of these growing movements to larger institutions and how they sort of institutionalize what they're doing and how they spread what they're doing. And I guess the flip side to it in some ways is that actually the major trade unions have also been on quite an impressive journey in the last sort of decade or so. You know, I think even, you know, even the really big unions like Unite are pretty different to where they were a decade ago. Even on, you know, environment stuff, that's a big move for them. But also just in terms of thinking about the way in which you do trade unionism these days, they're obviously going to be a bit more cautious, I think, than something like UVW. But I wonder if you have a sense of how that stuff is feeding back into those institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the as you say, that is a theme that increasingly crops up in the book, that there is a dynamic that can be positive and can also be a tension whereby these younger, smaller insurgent movements, be it trade unions, be it within the institutionalized kind of Labour Party, and maybe we'll get on to Momentum and the World Transformed later, are both capable of infecting, as you were, those kind of larger, more bureaucratic institutions that move at a kind of glacial pace and often have in the past been rooted in politics. And I mean, it's the case with both huge unions like Unite and, of course, something as big as the Labour Party, that there are many different epicentres of power within those organisations, many different brands of politics, but at times have had far more of a kind of safety first approach, don't rock the boat. The extent to which they are becoming, as I say, infected by these younger insurgent movements, but also the danger that the younger movements can become institutionalised by their interaction together. I mean, I think one of the book's arguments is that it doesn't have to be an either or, right? And as I say, we'll get on to Labour, but that being a prime example of people agonising with good reason over whether or not grassroots social movements are in danger of being co-opted by a much bigger, more august, and often quite problematic organisation in the shape of the Labour Party. Or whether, you know, they should strike out on their own, or they should, you know, be working really hard to kind of grab this moment of opportunity to influence the kind of levers of formal power. The fact is, it doesn't have to be an either or. You know, the fact that we have Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party, for example, creates space for younger and more grassroots movements to do their thing. And vice versa, you know, the fact that these organisations exist allows formal institutions like the Labour Party, the fact, and in the same way, the fact that United Voices of the World exists should enable and encourage and propel organisations like Unite to rethink the way they're doing things and to open up to precarious workers, to freelancers, to the self-employed, to networks that they often fear are beyond the reach of conventional union organising, and it should encourage them to look at that and to adopt it. And the McStrike movement is a really prime example of that, because that is a group of workers that were traditionally by some unions considered unorganisable. For those that don't know the McStrike movement, it's the movement by incredibly brave and dynamic movement by McDonald's workers demanding a living wage. And that has grown up organically within the workplaces. I meet some of the key people there. They've got fantastic stories. You know, the stories of how word of a potential strike spreads from colleague to colleague, shift to shift, branch to branch, under the noses of these very anti-union managers. But the Bakers Union, which has been around for over 100 years and is one of these big traditional unions affiliated to the Labour Party, part of the TUC and so on, managed to connect with that. And, you know, bring its institutional expertise and heft whilst being open to the new ideas and the dynamism of the McStrikers themselves. And, you know, in the book I describe one of the McStrikers saying, you know, we've set a ball rolling down the high street. And they have, you know, from Wetherspoons to every kind of fast food outlet you can think of, workers are organising and they are moving out, walking out. And they are winning as they go.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me that there is something here about the way in which these organizations are discovering like the basics of trade unionism, in a sense, right? That kind of like on shift organizing, that kind of very, very, you know, granular, close up, forms. You know, even like there's a lovely vignette in the book of UVW negotiating on the picket line with these bosses, saying, you know, with the bosses saying, okay, we'll have a meeting, and then demanding the date of the meeting there and then, and refusing to move into. So that's kind of very inspiring. And there is actually something, maybe in terms of the longer historical movement here, is like actually the consequences of really, you know, attempting to smash and fetter the trade unions in this way is that people have to rediscover these things. And that actually is very, very hopeful.
Yeah.
And the flip side, of course, of this in terms of thinking the longer term, you know, and we talked a little bit about Windrush, we talked a little bit about Yar's Word, is how many of these are migrant workers or workers with, you know, sometimes with irregular migration status, or sometimes people who've been here a long time, or people who have moved from country to country, sometimes people who have moved within the European Union as well. And you just make a remark in the book, but it did strike me as actually something I hadn't thought about before. But the way in which in the United States is a very kind of clear and cohesive movement around dreamers, right? So these are people who arrived as children of migrants, and they were here from a very young age, and there's a very cohesive political movement around it. There doesn't seem to me, and you mentioned that there are these kind of relatively small campaigns led by migrants themselves, it doesn't seem to me that there is a clear and cohesive equivalent movement here. Do you have any sense as to why that might be?
You're right that's something that that chapter in particular set around both Glasgow and Dungavel, which is an immigration detention centre in South Lanarkshire, not far out of the city, really, really picks up on. And I end up in the book at a meeting, a sort of workshop of different radical movements based in and around Glasgow, many different migrant-led organisations there, discussing exactly that question. Part of it, I think, is about the way in which in Britain at the moment, particularly with Brexit, we are navigating a whole host of very problematic and very sticky and pervasive narratives about race and empire that it can be really hard to cut through. I talk about Theo and Yusra as these guys who have been in different ways victims of the hostile environment regime. And they are, I argue in the book, the Brexit referendum was about many things. One of the things it was about was the two of them, not consciously, not deliberately, but it was about creating this kind of hazy and racialized other against which the kind of coherence of a supposedly authentic British working class could be built and defended. And, you know, it's really striking, and I mentioned this a few times, that the right has actually been far less afraid of talking about class, not in the way that we would understand it in a Marxist sense, but actually in a very persuasive to many people and convincing sense about, a governing class, a ruling class that is a sort of assemblage of cultural technocrats and Guardian readers and the intelligentsia. And it's kind of this larceny whereby the real kind of working grafters of Britain are having their kind of, you know, gains snatched away from them and their lives made harder. And one of the in answer to the question of, you know, why hasn't this kind of broader migrant movement built? Well, part of it is because so much energy has to be devoted to the day-to-day emergency defensive actions of stopping people being dragged onto chartered deportation planes, resisting Home Office raids. But it is also, and this is a bigger issue that needs a whole many hours to discuss, but also I think we're sometimes blasé about the degree to which anti-migrant narratives can be prevalent on the left as well as the right. And that's, again, something I pick up in the book, and I try and look at the history of the way that trade union movements as well have, going back to the 19th century here, and all the way through the 20th, have constantly created these racialized others by which to try and rally a supposedly kind of authentic working class solidarity. And it's, you know, it happened to the Irish, it happened to the Jews, with the 1905 Aliens Act, which I talk about in the book, and you had kind of the Clarion, and you had Beatrice Webb talking about, you know, the dirty and diseased vermin of the Jews who were coming to destroy the British working class. And of course you had it with Black and Asian migrants in the mid-20th century and post-war. And what I try and put through in the book is that, through the story of Theo and Yusra, you can really see two different formations of class and two different narratives that go with them. You have that right-wing construction that I've just been talking about, and you also have a mobilization that draws on an alternative history of working class struggle, one which is led by these so-called racialized outsiders themselves in alliance with kind of allies right across the working class. And that is the one that I find most moving and that I find most optimism in.
One way of reading the book or reading your work is that it tracks the way in which these movements have sprung up in the wake of the financial crisis and struggled and experimented and tried on forms and tried on these methods of organisation. And this is often my feeling about the movement around Jeremy Corbyn, about the movement that has kind of found a home in the Labour Party. About where it comes from, right? You have this energy sort of bouncing around, and it sort of tries the Occupy movement, and it tries the anti-austerity movement, and it tries everything in between. And it's found a bit of a home there. It's found a bit of an institutional form. And it's found a form which it can leverage. And obviously, we've sort of alluded to that tension between energy and institution. But for people, I think, in the Labour Party, and especially those who joined since 2015... I'm a bit suspicious of people who are in the Labour Party prior to 2015, but that's just me. But there can be something almost like self-congratulatory about this, right? Or like even like a reinvention of a kind of Whig history, that like as if this movement were always unfolding towards this kind of institutional form, and now it's arrived, so it's the end point of that instance. I think I sense in your work a kind of hesitancy about that position.
Yeah.
What do you think people who are inclined to that view should be cautious about?
Well, I think several things. I mean, the notion that we are on a sort of inevitable march to progress, and, you know, within the Labour Party, never mind kind of within our wider political system. The first thing they need to be cautious about is reality. on a wider sense, I think the past few years, and particularly the past few months in Britain, have really been, and I think you yourself have written about this for the LRB brilliantly, a sort of bonfire of liberal and Whiggish illusions about the structure of the state, about our constitution, about the kind of democratic norms which supposedly govern our lives. Pankaj Mishra has actually written brilliantly about this in relation to Modi in India, but also other autocrats and authoritarian populists that Britain props up and supports around the world. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt being another of them. This sense of, you know, they are barbarians, but there are barbarians, and, you know, now the barbarians in terms of kind of attacks on constitutional legitimacy and the democracy and so on are very much not just at the gate but inside the gate, and we're seeing that in Westminster. Now I think you can bring that to bear on the Labour Party as well. You know, I talk in the book about how the Labour Party has you know, that in the past something wider than the Labour Party as merely an electoral machine was part of Labour history. You know, in the early 20th century, you had socialist choirs and radical cycling clubs and so on, although it largely came from a more paternalistic rather than democratic kind of impulse. Then you see kind of constituency Labour parties really honing in on that kind of electoral kind of project. And now, thankfully, that is being challenged. But that is being challenged through the incredibly hard work and kind of epic struggle of people both inside the Labour Party kind of and outside of it. I think, I mean, in terms of the complacency of this idea that, you know, both the transformation of the Labour Party and after that the transformation of the country are inevitable, it really, really underestimates the threat both within the party, where it's a daily struggle, and not just against the right of the party, but I would argue against those who want to pull the Corbyn project in the direction of the soft left and saying that, do you know what, yes, you know, the sins of late capitalism are legion, what we need is a return to a kind of familiar Keynesian social democracy. Which would certainly be preferable from the kind of neoliberal dystopia we're living in now, but ultimately misses the point, which is that, you know, the new political project that we need to build cannot rest on a kind of, you know, post-war Fordist consensus. We have to build something more radical. And the one thing that encouraged me about this conference that has just happened, that we both attended, was that for the first time, really actually from the leadership, as opposed to from those grassroots movements like Momentum, like The World Transformed, I began to hear the language that I was hoping for, as well as the policies that I would like to see, in terms of, there was a line Jeremy Corbyn had in his conference speech about, we are not just here to defend the gains of previous generations, we are here to build a country fit for the next generation, which sounds like a soundbite. But actually, when you break it down, is a really important statement of intent. So, I think, you know, that struggle is ongoing. It is daily, and it is urgent, because up against us is a hard right movement and a far right movement that does have a radical vision, that is not looking for merely a return to the past, even though it often activates kind of imperial imagery and problematic narratives from the past, but actually has a radical sort of neoliberal nativism vision for the future. And we need to match that level of insurgency and radicalism to win.
It's, I think we probably both agree that there is, you know, there's a struggle going on inside the Labour Party about what politics is, right? And this is something that comes out very strongly in your chapter on Momentum, your chapter which begins at The World Transformed, the fringe event the sort of left fringe event at conference in 2017. And there is this kind of very exciting, disruptive, energy to it. And it does form an interesting venue in some ways, right? Not just The World Transformed, but Momentum as well itself, right? So the chapter is both at TWT and thinking about the formation of Momentum. And you speak to a guy called Santiago, who has the most phenomenal story, which I hope you'll tell. But TWT and Momentum itself do seem to form this kind of transversal between these movements and institutions. And it's a very difficult one. But it does seem, you know, obviously the pessimist's view, and I'm often inclined to pessimism, is that all of this energy is just being kind of, you know, like sucked under like a tectonic plate, sliding under and sort of being, you know, melted into the structure of the Labour Party. I think that can often be the case when, you know, things are concentrating on sort of media representation and fighting those battles in the press, which are, I think, important. But there is definitely something else going on there. It's something you track. And I think I think Santiago's story is actually the way into it. So tell us a bit about that.
Santiago is a brilliant guy, fantastic character. His father is the son of a regional official from Chile under the Allende government, who was put in a concentration camp after the Pinochet coup, and the family were kind of scattered to different parts of the world, and Santiago was born here in Britain and spent actually his younger days on protests outside Pinochet's home when Pinochet obviously ended up in the UK, and there was a huge legal battle over whether or not he would be extradited. So he was born in that kind of social movement world, in the very kind of vibrant and often militant world of kind of Latin American London politics, and he ends up joining the Labour Party in his mid-teens, very, very uninspired though by, you know, constituency meetings, by the kind of incredibly unambitious policy agenda, by the sense of kind of tinkering rather than the radical transformation. And he ends up working as a labourer on a building site and helping to construct kind of these incredibly luxurious homes in sort of the early and mid 2010s for global financiers and millionaires. And there's some great details about his life on the building site. Anyway, one day he hears that there's going to be a leadership election, and a guy that very few people have ever taken seriously, if they've even heard of him, is running to be leader. And that is Jeremy Corbyn. Now, for Santiago, Jeremy Corbyn is a familiar name, not just because Santiago is from Islington, but also because the Labour MP who was always hanging around those pickets and those Chilean solidarity protests was Jeremy Corbyn himself, which I think is a really interesting way into thinking about that nexus between kind of grassroots social movement politics and the institutional Labour Party. And once Corbyn becomes leader, Santiago goes to work for Momentum. And I try and tell through Santiago, and he's so perceptive, and he's so interested in these issues and thinks about them very, very generously and very carefully, these tensions between that world that he comes from, where the people he hangs out with and the people he knows were more likely, the closest they would get to a Labour Party conference when they were growing up was protesting outside of it, right, against the Iraq War and against tuition fees. I dare say that's a familiar state of mind. Suddenly being thrust into a world where he is being told, first of all, and then helping to organise, Momentum members and Momentum delegates to go and make sure they win the vote for the, Yorkshire and Humber position on the National Policy Forum, or ensuring that the conference arrangement committees, has sufficient kind of Momentum members to win the day. And I use the landscape of Brighton in 2017, where the Labour conference was hosted, to sort of physically map this out. You know, you had these places like the Synergy Centre, where we were all kind of getting drunk on Red Stripe, and Diane Abbott would wave through a haze of dry ice whilst we all chanted for the nationalisation of Greggs. And people like Ian Lavery and Clive Lewis coming from the official conference centre to kind of witness that and to talk it up and be inspired by it. But at the same time, people like Santiago going the other way onto the official conference floor and having to engage in this quite bureaucratic and institutional politics that's very, very unfamiliar. And that tension runs the entire way through that chapter, and it includes some voices who are sceptical of what Momentum can achieve in that realm, and are also worried about the impact that that sort of institutionalization can have on movements that have originated outside the Labour Party. A woman called Eva Jasiewicz, who is fantastic, who is a brilliant activist that many people will be aware of, and has a foot in both camps. She is a supporter of Momentum and does stuff with Momentum, but also works with lots of community projects and solidarity movements. She talks about her concerns that Momentum becomes nothing more than a kind of slightly more radical route into representative politics, a kind of treasure trove of activist capital. So that's not how you build solidarity movements. The thing is, I think that people at Momentum are thinking through these issues. They are thinking through these problems. They are constantly aware of them. The difficulty is that the harder, more intangible social movement building stuff is always more difficult to quantify and always seems less urgent than the latest battle with the PLP or indeed the next general election. And so I think navigating that tension is going to, whether we are members of Momentum and Labour or not, for all of us, is going to be a really interesting task over the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. I mean, I suppose the flip side of this and the thing I think is important and it's also in the chapter is, you witness the kind of organising training or how to go out and speak to people. And this kind of stuff doesn't get that much attention. And I think there are two things, one is the need for this, and I mean your final chapter, which we won't delve into in length, but is interested in the wake of deindustrialization, the smashing of industry in the north, and the very different responses to it, right? Like the long enduring memory of an organized working class, the big meeting, but also at the same time, like people who are around and from that community who are very sceptical of the left and are very kind of sucked into the vortex of social media, are kind of very pro-Trump, for instance. And so there is that question about organising, about how to deploy the resources of Momentum, the resources of the Labour Party towards getting in touch with people like this. It just struck me also that kind of training, the organiser training, canvassing training, also has a long inheritance, not just from like the Alinskyite community organising stuff, which Labour is doing as well, but in addition, the kind of climate movement, the kind of seeds for change, trainer facilitating stuff like that. So there's a long inheritance going in here that I think is hugely, hugely important. Obviously, there are inarguable structural factors here. There is the climate change, and one of the people you speak to is a climate activist, very sceptical about the Labour Party's kind of climate commitments. I hope that's changed a bit since the latest conference. And obviously, there's a danger sometimes, especially for those of us who are invested in the Labour Party, and at this point I am, I think most of the left is, that our sense is that everything turns on this coming election. And it does, because so much is important that will be decided in that election, it does matter. But one of the things that I came out of the book really feeling very strongly was that, that Brecht line that because things are the way they are, they will not stay the way they are. And it gave me a real sense of hope, and that's quite a rare commodity. Just got a couple of minutes. So is that your sense now looking back on the work you've been doing here? And I guess if you had to draw up a balance sheet for the movement, what would you say? Is it looking healthy?
There is a quote at the end of the prologue, which is hugely important to me, and I think is a sort of brief way of answering that epic question and that urgent question. And it's from Rebecca Solnit, and she says, the future is dark, but it's a darkness as much of the womb as of the grave. Facile optimism has no place in the movement that as we stand right now, just as the breakdown of the late capitalist economic model, or at least the convulsions which have engulfed it, have created space for radical movements in all the different physical places and kind of whether it's workplaces or housing or education, all the things we've been talking about. So too has the far right taken advantage of that space and the kind of hollowing out of that liberal technocratic centre ground. So there is no room for complacency. But I think that in terms of where do I end up, the overriding sense that I get is that politics is being reanimated right now. Will Davies, the sociologist, talks about neoliberalism being the disenchantment of politics by economics. And we are seeing politics being re-enchanted by all kinds of things. And, some of them are dangerous, some of them are liberating. And that is what kind of fires me up as I look ahead to the future.
Brilliant. Okay, that is a perfect place to leave it. Jack Schenker, thank you so much for joining me today. Now we have your attention. New Politics of the People is out now from Bodley Head. I have been James Butler. This has been Navarra FM on Resonance 104.4 FM. I will be back at the same time in the same place next week. Bye-bye.